Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is June 25th, 2016, and this is episode 114, the inevitable Mighty Number 9 episode. Welcome once again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week we're discussing the recent release of Mighty Number 9.
Finally.
Right? So buckle in and get ready for that. But first we have our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits. Slaggy, you want to get us started?
Yes. The recent release of Warcraft, the movie from director Duncan Jones, has officially topped the list of top grossing video game movies, stealing the first place spot from Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time. Of course, a lot of these ticket sales and box office monies came from China, where it was like pretty much the most successful movie ever.
Yeah, it broke a lot of records in China. I don't know about most successful movie ever, but it broke
That's
a lot of records.
Pretty much. So despite the lukewarm reception in the States, it was a massive success worldwide, and I would expect to definitely see a sequel at some point.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I think that I did see the Warcraft movie. I don't know if we talked about that on air here. I really enjoyed it, though. I'm a big Warcraft fan, and I feel like that tends to be the way that goes. A lot of the people who are not familiar with the game lore were really lost. They thought there wasn't really like a point. But those of us who are into Warcraft lore, and I'm certainly not the way that you are, Slaggy, but I have an appreciation for it, and seeing it play out on screen, I was really into it.
Yeah, it was great, in my opinion.
Excellent. We also have word here that Disney XD has picked up another 50 episodes of Yo-Kai Watch to localize.
What is this, Anime Buoy?
They will be beginning airing August 1st, 2016. And that set of 50 episodes, as I understand, is going to carry over storyline-wise to sort of the Yo-Kai Watch 2 era. Yo-Kai Watch 2, as we previously discussed, will be releasing in North America on 3DS September 30th.
Oh boy, lots of games in September.
We also have word here that Square Enix will be revealing a new character for the arcade Dissidia game on June 27th. So, by the time you're hearing this episode, future person, you will know who the new character in Dissidia is. We don't as we're recording this, so you are better informed than we. Have fun.
So, we have learned that in South Park, The Fractured Butthole, you'll be able to choose to play as a girl character if you would like. And Matt Stone was talking to Entertainment Weekly about how they wanted to include the playable character as a girl in Stick of Truth, but they were so far in development that, you know, they would have had to basically start over. So this time around, they wanted to include that. And there's, you know, talking about how kind of like the concept of when they were planning it about like, how are the boys going to react? So, I mean, I would hope that, you know, it's probably Cartman who's just going to be the asshole. And, you know, they'll probably, Cartman always is made to look like an asshole for being an asshole. So hopefully it will be done tastefully.
Yeah, you know, I have to say in Stick of Truth, there is a storyline that would not make sense if you're a female character, just in case you were listening to that excuse and thinking that this was like a Ubisoft, like female bodies are too hard to render. Like, at least there's half a reason for it. Like, I find it really disappointing that it didn't occur to them to have female playable characters until they were halfway through their development cycle. But I am willing to give them the benefit of the doubt that it is true that narratively one of the story events in the game would not work if you were a playable girl character. So, you know, I'll give them that, and I'm happy to hear that, you know, they're really being more inclusive for Fractured Butthole. We also have word here that the next Final Fantasy XIV expansion is going to be revealed at the upcoming October Fan Festival. So that, of course, is going to be very, very exciting, especially for those of us who still play Final 14 from time to time. So keep your eyes open, and we will definitely be talking about that come October.
On July 1st, we will be getting more information about Pokemon Sun and Moon. This will be occurring at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 10 p.m. Japanese Standard Time.
Oh, wow. That's very exciting. You know, really cool thing about the sort of hype train for Sun and Moon, I feel, is that they've been doing all of these reveals, like, worldwide. Like, we haven't had to, mostly, we haven't had to, like, piece together information from, like, Korokoro or, like, some random, like, issue of Video Game Jump or whatever. Like, we're getting worldwide reveals for this game, and I think that's really cool.
Yeah, there's no details on what's going to be revealed, but we will definitely be talking about it in another week or so.
Excellent. We also have word out of Square Enix that there's going to be a major announcement for their smartphone game, Final Fantasy Brave Exvius. That'll be on a Nico Nico Live stream event. They have a countdown site up on the official Final Fantasy Brave Exvius website. It's going to tick down on June 27th. So again, all of y'all out there in Internet Radio Land will know about this before we do. Since this is
it's
happening...
not fair.
Right? Because this is happening at the same time or around the same time as the Dissidia reveal, there's a part of me that's hoping it's the same character across both games being introduced.
Oh, that one makes sense.
Yeah, I feel like that would be cute.
Do you think it's gonna be like Noctis or something?
Oh man, that would be awesome. And you know, they did always say they would start looking at crossing over Noctis once 15 was done, and they're probably getting toward the point now where development is wrapping up. You'd gotta think, right? The game's coming out in just a couple more months.
Let's hope.
Right? And last but certainly not least here on our follow-ups, we have a huge slate of new SNK news. Basically, Japanese website 4Gamer interviewed the producer of King of Fighters 14, the battle designer, one of SNK's big artists, and a former Capcom worker who now works with SNK. That is, in that order, Yasuyuki Oda-san, Hayato Watanabe-san, Eisuke Ogura-san, and Neo G. And, you know, they talked a lot about the development of the current King of Fighters game. They also talked about some legacy SNK news. You can get a full translation of this interview over at Madman's Cafe. But, you know, a couple of things I wanted to talk about here. I saw people posting about it on Gaff, and I completely agree. Oda-san does have an eventual idea for Goro, Mark of the Wolves. Because the fans keep requesting it so frequently, he feels like he should make it one day. And in fact, 4Gamer ran a really amazing photo of character designs for the originally scrapped Mark of the Wolves sequel that we had never seen before. Got confirmation on some characters that actually ended up appearing in later KOF games, and some characters that have never made a reappearance. So definitely very interesting stuff if you're interested in that SNK tip, which we certainly are. Oda would also like to make another Art of Fighting game, since he felt like the series never really hit its stride. He'd also like to make a new Athena game, and he would like to personally make a new Metal Slug game.
Wow.
Yeah, right? Ogura-san, the artist, wants to make a new World Heroes game.
Oh my god.
Because he feels like his art and his character design can go as crazy as he wants, and nobody will complain about it, because it's World Heroes.
Oh, wow.
So that would be cool. And then Watanabe-san wants to make a new installment in the Buriki 1 series. And the funny or interesting thing about that is Buriki 1 is not very well liked. It's a very strange, like, grapple wrestling type game. It's not super good, but Watanabe-san thinks that now that consoles typically come with two analog sticks, that he could actually make a really great grappler using both sticks.
Huh.
I think that's interesting. I'd be interested in trying it out. And he also has a strong interest in making a new fighting game series or a new action game series.
And then Neo G wants to make a Samurai Showdown.
Yeah, he actually wants to make like a super mature Samurai Showdown. I think that would be amazing, like to come in and like almost do what
Konami and Capcom aren't doing.
Well, I was actually going to say what Square Enix was trying to do with Bushido Blade for the PlayStation 1.
Oh.
Which, you know, if you may recall, that game was actually fairly violent, fairly bloody, especially in North America. You know, as I understand it, other regions did not have quite as bloody a game as we did, but, you know, you would do sword slashes, and it would be, like, very, like, Japanese, like, samurai cinema, where you would have, like, a slash, both parties would slash, and then you just see, like, a blood spray, and then you're like, oh my gosh, which one of us got hit? And it was, like, really tense. It was really cool. And I sort of get the feeling, reading over these comments by Neo G, that that's what he would like to make, is sort of like an adult Samurai Showdown game, violent, bloody, but with, like, the serious taste for, like, Japanese samurai drama.
He should change his name to Neo G-O, now.
Ah! Well, that about does it for our follow-ups this week, but we do have some release news. I believe we previously discussed that Phantom Brave is releasing on Steam July 25th, but we have word here that Nipponichi Software America will be releasing a limited edition physical edition, which is going to be called Phantom Brave PC Chroma Edition.
Cool.
This will be available exclusively from the Nipponichi Software America online store. It's going to come with an art book, 5 mini art prints, a collectible box, and a Steam code for the game. You will also get a $5 discount on the Phantom Brave mouse pad that they sell on their store. And I checked to make sure that this wasn't one of those mouse pads with like a wrist support in the shape of boobies.
Oh yeah.
It is not. You are safe.
Oh good.
We also have word here that Furyu is going to be releasing a new Beyblade game for 3DS in Japan in November. This is Beyblade Burst, and it will be in stores in Japan November 10th.
We have word that the upcoming Berserk Musou is going to be releasing in Japan on September 21st, so please look forward to that.
And you know, I do have to say, the part of me that's very into like trigger warnings and stuff, if you're a fan of Berserk, there is reason to believe that some really bad stuff that happened to Casca in the narrative is going to be depicted in the game. So if you are sensitive to certain physically violent acts, you should definitely be you know, sort of wary. Somewhat interestingly, though, is that the game did not get the harshest rating available to Japanese video games by Sero or Kero. So that's a good thing. It's not Sero Z. It's like one down. So if that awful incident is depicted, it's probably not going to be so graphic. Like, it's not going to be like full on camera dirty grossness. So that's at least like a little bit of comfort. But yeah, definitely trigger warning on that one. It could get pretty bad.
So Konami's Yu-Gi-Oh! Duel Monsters.
Konami's publishing a video game?
Right? Well, it's a free-to-play title. It's Yu-Gi-Oh! Duel Monsters Ultimate Card Battle. That's coming on July 6th for 3DS in Japan. And interestingly, you're playing as a new protagonist. So apparently you're not Yugi.
Oh, interesting. Also interesting is that some of the official art for this game does have the anime protagonists pictured. So I'm really wondering if this new character...
You're like a Mary Sue.
Yeah, fighting like the characters from the show.
And like Yugi is like your mentor or whatever.
Yeah, and I mean, I make jokes about it, but like I would be here for that. So I'm really hopeful about that.
Yeah, I mean, all I know is that you could probably expect some blue eyes white dragon.
Most certainly. We also have word here that One Piece Grand Pirate Colosseum will be releasing for 3DS in Japan September 21st, 2016. I'm really excited about this. This is the sprite-based 2D fighting game, and I am so excited to play a sprite-based 2D fighting game based on One Piece. I think that the characters in One Piece are super cool, super interesting, and I can't wait to give this game
a go.
A lot
of them are kind of sexy. I've never really realized that.
Oh, dude, One Piece has tons of sexy dudes. Like, I mean, like, you know who Roronoa Zoro is, right?
Oh, I do.
And last, but definitely not least, we have word here that Res Infinite will be launching on October 13th, alongside the PSVR. It is presently slated as a digital release title, no physical, but I'm really excited. That also makes me feel like it's probably not going to be like bank-breakingly expensive. And considering how much money PSVR is going to cost, I'm glad to hear that. Any thoughts, Slaggy?
Get your trans vibrator ready.
Ah, could you imagine? All right, well, with all of that having been said and
something,
done.
Something teledildonics.
With all of that having been said and done, I think it's time for some news.
News. Oh my god, news.
All right, we have word here from Final Fantasy creator Hironobu Sakaguchi-san that he is planning on opening a new company. This will not be replacing Mistwalker. This is actually supposed to be like a sort of the flip side of the same coin to Mistwalker. This will be Dawnwalker, And it's going to specifically be a company for development. You know, Mistwalker is primarily for like production stuff, to do consultation on design stuff. But it sounds like Sakaguchi-san is ready to get his, you know, hands dirty in doing game design and development again. So I think this is a great thing. It's been interesting the way that Mistwalker has worked with other companies, primarily recently Silicon Studio. But I would be really excited to see what he and his team could produce themselves without outside help or assistance.
Excellent. So we have word from Level 5 that their Level 5 Vision 2016 event will be July 27th from 3:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. Japanese Standard Time. And so, you know, we're expecting more from Snack World, more Yo-Kai Watch, and who knows what else?
The theme of the event is new heroes.
New heroes.
So I definitely think there's going to be some interesting stuff going on here. We do know that there's going to be at least one new, straight up new IP, and that's something that Level 5 has been teasing a little bit over the last couple of weeks, so I'm very excited to see what Level 5 has in store for us. I think they've become a really big name in games, and I'm just very excited to see what's to come.
Me too.
And last, but certainly not least, we have word here that Tencent, you're probably familiar with Tencent, they are a Japanese, like, mega online game company at this point. has bought the Finnish game studio Supercell.
Wait, did you say Japanese?
I'm sorry, Finnish.
No,
or Tencent. No, Tencent is Chinese.
Chinese, yeah.
Sorry. Either way, Supercell is probably best known for Clash of Titans.
Clash of Clans. Kotaku reported it wrong.
Ah, that's so funny because in my head I was even thinking like Clash of Clans, but I still read it as it was written. You know, obviously Clash of Clans is like one of the biggest games ever, so...
Yeah, that's that cute little mobile game, right? Where there's like the little guys that are like, arr!
Yes, although what you just described could technically be many, many hundreds of games. I know, you're talking about like with the television commercials. And yes, that is them, with all the CGI rendered television ads and stuff.
And I feel like there was a cute skeleton.
Yes, there in fact was a cute skeleton. So this is something that's really interesting. Tencent, you know, they've also bought like a majority stake in Riot Games. They have a stake in Epic Games. So they're definitely making a name for themselves with these acquisitions. And I'm very interested. Obviously, I think both Riot and Epic are doing better than ever in a lot of ways right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really interested in what Tencent can bring to the table for Supercell to get better.
Right. I mean, when you look at that combined with the fact that Warcraft, the movie, you know, did so well in China, I think people are going to be paying a lot more attention to, that region.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, we have a couple of pieces of news that are extremely controversial.
Controversial.
Oh my god.
All right. Well, this first one here is sort of the theme of this entire episode. the first piece of controversial news is, of course, that the release of Mighty No. 9 happened, and it itself went very messy. Now, we are going to talk a little bit about the history of Mighty No. 9, so I don't want to go too deep into it here, but the TLDR is, and I don't expect that we'll talk about this in the main discussion, is that at the time of the actual release, things happened, like a lot of the backers were getting codes that didn't work, people were getting, like, no emails, like, no codes. A lot of people were very upset that, you know, this was a kickstarted game. The game was, out for review for weeks before it actually released. And a lot of backers were very upset that, you know, they felt that since they had put money toward this game, they should have been playing the game weeks earlier than they were. So there's a lot of negativity going on around Mighty No. 9 right now, which that is actually why we're doing this episode today. But I just wanted to separately call attention specifically to sort of the drama of the actual release. Sagi, what do you have to say about any of this?
Just unfortunate that along with all of the other messes involved with this game that this had to not go smoothly.
Yeah.
It's just a shame.
Yeah. As far as I know, most of these issues have resolved at this point. I was following a lot of people on GAF who had issues in those initial days. But it seems like at this point, most people have gotten their codes and gotten it to work. So that's good at least, but still very interesting. And I think it's particularly interesting that people felt upset about not being able to play the game in advance at the time that reviewers were playing it. And that's one that I actually agree with. A lot of the complaints and a lot of the controversy surrounding Mighty No. 9 right now, I don't agree with. That one I do. I actually do think it's a little silly that the people who put money into the game, invested to make it happen, didn't get to play it right away. I think that's a little ridiculous. So moving forward, we also have the great news that Oculus is no longer blocking the third-party application that lets Vive owners play Oculus Rift exclusive. There was something very interesting. It was a third-party app called Revive. And what Revive would let you do is allow you to legitimately buy Oculus-exclusive games and play them on your non-Oculus headset. And basically what happened was, you know, the Rift people, they didn't want people who were gaming on non-Rifts playing their games. It sort of broke the whole idea that they had set up contracts for Rift exclusivity. A lot of people complain, though. You know, a lot of people not happy with that kind of DRM, not wanting to be unable to play a game just because they bought what is effectively the wrong monitor or wrong display unit. And, you know, it's really cool that at least at the moment, Oculus has stepped down. They've removed that hardware check, and you know, they're in the future saying that they won't be using hardware checks as a part of their DRM platform on PC in the future.
That's really interesting because, you know, Oculus is owned by Facebook now, right?
It is, yeah.
So, I mean, that's really interesting that, but I mean, I guess, you know, Facebook is very, like, hacker friendly, so, you know, I guess it kind of makes sense in some ways.
Yeah, and you know, the thing to me is I get the initial concern. I actually do get why they initially were concerned because, you know, where contracts are involved, you can never be too careful. And if you've paid someone for exclusivity, like, you probably want to get something good on that. But the flip side is, if people are using these hacks to legitimately access your store and pay you money for your games, then why do you really care what device they're wearing on their head? And it sounds like that's ultimately where they ended up on it. And I have to say, honestly, good on Oculus. That was a really great move. Do you have anything else to add, Slaggy?
Nope.
All right. Well, then let's move on to some sad news with a... All right, this is going to be a short but sweet doom and gloom this week. We have word that Devil's Third will be shutting down its online connectivity coming December 28th. This is interesting, of course, because the game is, at time of this recording, not even a year old yet. It did make its debut last year on August 4th, 2015, and it'll be losing its online functionality at the end of this year. They're also no longer going to be selling the Golden Egg Surface, service. That is the microtransaction used in the game. It's like golden eggs are like premium currency. Exactly. So, you know, that's very interesting. That'll no longer be available starting on June 27th. Once again, that date popping up. So definitely some interesting stuff. If you're a big fan of Devil's Third, I know there are some of you out there. I would definitely say play as much of this game as you can before December, because after that, the experience will never be the same again.
Yeah, and you know, the price drop is effective already, so...
Oh yeah, for the digital version of Devil's Third, the price is reduced effective immediately from $59.99 to $29.99.
I'm just like, he's hot.
It's
Pride Weekend, IGGAF.
Nice. We also have a smash hit this week, and that is an article coming out of Kotaku. And I want to highlight this because this is a really interesting piece. It's about the rumor that was circulating back during E3 that someone was trying to steal the Zelda Breath of the Wild E3 demo. And basically, Patricia Hernandez really went out of her way to, like, really work out, is this a real thing someone was trying to do? What methods were they going to use to do it? What stopped them, etc., etc.? And the answers to all of these questions, she actually did find legitimate answers. She talked to people in the Wii U hacking community, and really wrote an article that goes into such a level of detail on how this heist very, very nearly worked. I do not believe this heist is a lie. I absolutely believe in the Zelda heist. It just sounds like they were not quite able to make it work, but this story is actually really fascinating. I highly recommend people read it. It's just a really neat article, really neat story, and it really shows you the ingenuity of some of these console hackers in the modern day.
Yeah, definitely.
So, all right, with all that having been said, it's time to begin our discussion here. So we here at the show, we have a very interesting relationship with Mighty No. 9. Slaggy's probably sitting over there wondering, like, what are you talking about? But in one of our earliest episodes, we were talking about the 2013 Penny Arcade Expo, And while we were recording the episode talking about PAX that year, as we were doing like sort of our outro, the exit mood,
that's
as we
right.
speak, my phone started blowing up. I believe it was one of the boys from Koopa Club, pouring out a 40, who was texting like, OMG, did you see the news? And it was like, what are you talking about? And, you know, I try not to text while the show is going on. But when someone is like, OMG, did you see the news? Even though we're mid-recording, I basically did like to slaggy emotion, like, just keep talking. I need to look into this. And it turned out that Keiji Inafune-san talked at PAX about the Kickstarter campaign that would be launching, I want to say that day, but if not that day, then almost immediately after. The Kickstarter campaign, of course, was for a Mega Man Revival project. Inafune-san, for those of you who are listening to this show and maybe don't know, is he's looked at as the father of Mega Man. It's a little bit wrong to some degree. He primarily was involved in Mega Man in the early days at Capcom, but he actually didn't originally like create Mega Man is the thing. He was on the team for the first Mega Man game, but he wasn't like the director or anything. He did, as far as I understand, mostly just like some art concepts. He refined sort of the illustrations of the character, almost like a reverse character design. He himself has described it, where he had character, like there was already character designs done, but he refined it and sort of gave Mega Man the spark to become Mega Man. So that's something that I find really interesting about Inafune-san all the time, that I think a lot of people, even us here on this show, sometimes neglect to really look at. But either way, the idea behind this Mighty No. 9 Kickstarter was that Inafune-san was going to crowdfunding, since he could no longer work with Capcom to make a new Mega Man game. He wanted to create a spiritual successor to Mega Man using crowdfunding so that he could make the game that he felt the fans wanted and deserved. We learned about this while we were recording. Once I got all the news, I stopped Slagkick and very dramatically, like, OMG, I'm crying. And I mean, I had very strong emotional response to this news. Mega Man's a very important game to me, as all of you longtime listeners know. So, you know, it turns out he announces this Kickstarter. We talk about it literally the moment it's happening on air. We weren't live, obviously, but we did have a different workflow back then. So we would get the episodes edited as soon as possible and have them posted as soon as possible. We weren't, you know, waiting a day or two to get them to air on VOG or anything. So we had people who were listening to the show who heard about Mighty No. 9 through us. So it was a very interesting and different time, and project I was very passionate about. And to me, Mighty No. 9 is a game that I really hold very dear, because to me there is a connection between Mighty No. 9 and sort of what we do here. So basically, the concept for Mighty No. 9 was initially, you know, to very specifically create like a new Mega Man game, specifically sort of to spit in the eye of Capcom, because Keiji Inafune-san really believed that Mega Man could and should be like a big deal. They made a lot of promises at the time of the Kickstarter that, you know, we would get an unprecedented access to seeing the team at Comcept, which is Inafune-san's studio, working on the game. Inafune-san specifically said, you know, he really wanted the fan base to be involved in the design and development of Mighty No. 9, following the cancellation of Mega Man Legends 3 by Capcom, which at the time, Mega Man Legends 3 was doing a lot of Kickstarter type, like, input. They were doing a lot of, like, polls and stuff, letting the fan base sort of make development and design decisions. It was a really cool idea that Capcom had there, but unfortunately, it never really worked out. Initially, you know, there was some controversy because Mighty No. 9 was going to be a PC game primarily, and the console releases were stretch goals at like $2 million mark. And, you know, a lot of people were like, this is not a game I want to play on PC. I want to play it on my console. So Inafune-san did switch that around, put the console goals fairly low so that, you know, it was already taken care of. They ended up getting more than $4 million in their funding. So they actually got all of their stretch goals. They got music by a lot of really well-known Japanese game musicians. They got like a whole 8-bit retro soundtrack, which, by the way, I can say is phenomenal. They got a documentary series funded on the production and design of the game. They started doing like fan research on like the main character, who is named Beck. His partner is Call. Beck and Call, of course, like Rockman's Rock and Roll. You know, they started started doing design work with them, working with the community. Things are actually going really well. Comcept brought in Integrates, which is a really great Japanese dev studio. They've done a lot of work on some of the later Mega Man spinoffs, the Mega Man Zero series, the Mega Man ZX series.
And Mighty Gunvolt, right?
They did.
Well, I mean, Azure Striker Gunvolt.
They did Azure Striker Gunvolt, which a lot of people already feel is a worthwhile Mega Man spiritual successor. It must
be noted.
That
design like Mega Man Zero, kind of?
Yeah, it very much follows in the mold of Mega Man Zero, like, very much.
And then they literally did like a Mega Man, their own Mega Man clone, which was Mighty Gunvolt. That's why I was thinking of Mighty Gunvolt.
Yeah, and that's actually like done in the 8-bit style, which is kind of cool. It's a crossover game between Mighty Number 9, Gunvolt, and Galgun. Yeah. So overall, you know, things are actually going pretty well. They announced, you know, that they were had people coming on doing work for the soundtrack from the Mega Man games. Primarily, the soundtrack was composed by Manami Matsume-san, which, by the way, I think is amazing. Also, Ippo Yamada-san, Takashi Tateishi, Masahiro Aoki. So just a really, like, luminaries of that sort of 8-bit Japanese video game sound. Toward the end of the Kickstarter campaign, though, they gave us our first hint of news that was a little less good, and that was word that the game would be using the Unreal Engine. Now, a lot of us had concerns because the Unreal Engine has some issues on certain console hardware, and, you know, because all of the Kickstarter goals were met, they were launching something like 10 SKUs of this game, which is a lot, and Unreal Engine only properly and competently supported like half of those. And I bring that up because I think it's an important thing to remember in the modern day playing Mighty Number 9, but we'll touch back on that a little later. Inafune-san started talking about, you know, potentially working with publishers on the game to get the game officially published. And in fact, he even told the Game Informer in October, so, you know, just a month and a half later from like the original announcement practically, that he would have even been okay with working with Capcom to publish the game as an actual Mega Man game if that was what they wanted to do. So, you know, overall things looked really good. They released a trailer after the game was in active development for, what, like 7 days, just showing a sort of proof of concept how the game would run in Unreal Engine, and it looked pretty good. One of the things you hear a lot of people talk about is that during the initial pitch, though, they had a beautiful, like, very high resolution, like, art piece. It was a drawing of sort of a concept art of what they thought the game was going to look like, and it basically looked like a super HD Mega Man style game. And even when this first Unreal demo was shown, it was just like 15 seconds of gameplay footage, but it already did not look like that concept art, and already some concern, some disapproval was being voiced.
Yeah, it really set off some alarms.
Indeed. I don't know if the mics are going to pick this up, but there's a car alarm going off right outside of the SS Game Buoy right now. So, sorry, that totally threw off my groove. Basically, though, you know, things were mostly still looking good, but there were some voices already sort of expressing discontent. The following July, we got another crowdfunding campaign for Mighty Number 9. A lot of people started to get very concerned. Basically, Comcept started asking for another $200,000 for full English voice acting in the game. This raised a lot of concern because traditionally the Mega Man games don't have a whole lot of dialogue. The X games to some degree do from time to time, but we were not really talking about a Mega Man X game. That's not what people wanted or were expecting. And then the following October, they asked for an additional $198,000 to complete a DLC stage introducing a new rival for Beck, the female character Rey. I will say, you know, that obviously both of these things did ultimately get included in the game, and Rey is a very cool character, but these two sort of of going back to the plate for more after having already raised $4 million is something that a lot of people had a lot of problems with. You know, they were originally only asking for $900,000 in the first place. So to keep going back to the well, keep asking for more money, it started to really rub people the wrong way. So much so that, you know, a little while later, Inafune-san actually started another Kickstarter project. This was Red Ash, The Indelible Legend. And this was meant to be a spiritual successor to the Mega Man Legends series. Now, this hit at a time when basically Inafune-san and everyone at Intic Creates and Comcept were saying that Mighty No. 9 at that point was basically already completed. And that was in early 2015. So I want to say April or May 2015.
That sounds about right, yeah.
In fact, I just pulled that up and it looks like, yeah, this was actually July of 2015 that the Red Ash stuff happened. So, you know, there was a little bit of time. Game ostensibly would be more or less complete. They actually said that the solo campaign of Mighty No. 9 was 100% done at this point. So about after a year of development. And, you know, having played the game now, I'd say I would believe that it took them just that first year to get the core game done and the rest of the time was for additional stuff. Specifically, you know, they ended up getting a deal for publishing the game with Deep Silver. Deep Silver, you might be familiar with. We talk some trash about them from time to time because they've done some fairly poor game publishing where, stuff like Dead Island, they did the release of the special edition that was literally just like a zombie torso with big breasts.
Yep.
They've done several of the big releases of the Saints Row games, which have been less controversial and have gone off with fewer hitches. So basically, the game gets delayed at this point because while the solo campaign is 100% done and they're looking at for funding for their next game project, basically the publisher wanted them to release the solo campaign and the multiplayer campaign at the same time. The multiplayer stuff all having been stretch goals to the original release of the game. So as far as Red Ash goes, you know, they basically needed to launch a new project because, you know, half of the team that had worked on Mighty No. 9 weren't needed for the multiplayer stuff. So they were trying to get projects together for that staff to work on. I can understand that on a purely business level, especially now looking back. I can see how that works. At the time, it just felt like Inafune and Comcept going back to the well for more fan money to fund their game. And that actually, you know, Red Ash failed. It did not succeed. A Chinese publisher did step in order to save it, but, you know, that's sort of a lucky stroke for Comcept.
Yeah, and I remember at the time, everyone was like, oh, they already knew that they were going to have this partnership, you know, so this was just them being shady, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. That is the Chinese publisher Fuse that stepped in there. And they insist that Fuse did not step in until the Kickstarter was unsuccessful. So, you know, it's always been sort of a thing that conspiracy theorists whisper about. I'm not ready to whole hog go in on the Inafune-san is a con man train. That's actually a very common opinion in the modern age that, you know, especially now that people have played Mighty No. 9 and a lot of them didn't like it. And a lot of people haven't played it but insist it's a shit show because lol, that's what the zeitgeist says. And so at this point, you know, a lot of people feel that Inafune is a has-been. He is a thief, an outright crook, a con man who actively worked to deceive good intentioned fans. I don't buy any of that. I think he's just kind of inept at planning and business. I think that he's trying to do his best. I think in the modern, looking back now, you can really see how, like, Red Ash happened. I personally can understand why Mighty No. 9 launched in the state that it did, but we'll get to that in a minute. I just want to wrap up sort of the history. Basically, you know, the game was delayed repeatedly to the point that it became an internet meme, basically, that Mighty No. 9 kept getting delayed. It was delayed to early 2016, even after the multiplayer mode was finished in active development. It was delayed for bug testing and working out bugs. And that's not so bad. They said it would be coming early 2016. Most of us were willing to wait. It did at that point get delayed again to its actual release date of June 21st.
Doom 21st?
Did I say that in
you
such a way?
You almost did.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, so that did end up releasing on June 21st, Japan, North America, June 24th in the Powell regions. So either way, though, you know, that last delay, it actually hit everybody really hard. Inafune-san got very humble at that point, saying that, you know, basically the team had no excuse for their continual disappointment of fans and backers. A lot of commentators at that point were just like, you know, I don't even want anything to do with this game anymore. I think the game is going to be so dumb. I don't ever want to hear Inafune's name again. A lot of people, you know, at this point claiming that Mighty Number 9 would be the go-to example of crowdfunding gone wrong. And yet, none of this was quite as negative as the trailer for the game that Deep Silver published on May 25th, 2016, which was very disparaging. It not only presented the game in a very bad way, it actively like talked trash to the kind of people that like games like this. It had a line specifically that was literally, "Make the bad guys cry like an anime fan on prom night." Which is disgusting, offensive, and ironic, particularly given the fact that both of Concept's current projects, Red Ash and Mighty No. 9, have anime series planned and coming.
Well, Red Ash is like a 12-minute short.
Well, it's still an anime. Come on now. So, overall, this game, just absolute crap show. It was born of the very best intentions. It felt, at the time, like a whole new beginning to games development where we weren't going to be beholden to AAA publishers, where indies can revive long lost classics and revisit them in the modern age, giving them new life. It was an incredibly optimistic scene that Mighty No. 9 came out from initially, but now that it's released, it's sort of poisoned the well. And the reason we're doing this episode is, now that the game is out, Slykick and I have both played the game. I believe Slykick put some time with it but did not finish it. I have played it and finished it, so I feel like we're reasonably qualified, especially combined with both of our near encyclopedic knowledge of Mega Man, to have a discussion on Mighty No. 9. So, Slaggy, before we start talking about the game, is there anything you want to add?
No, I think you did a pretty good job of talking about the controversy leading up to it.
All right, so the game has finally released.
You know, I think the only thing that I would say is that, you know, even from the start, it was very ambitious. And also, just to keep in mind that producing games and developing games is expensive. I don't know how they could have done it on $900,000.
Yeah, no, I don't believe this game could have worked on $900,000. I think, you know, they probably were talking to several publishers before they even started the Kickstarter. I think they had faith. You know, we actually saw that with Bloodstained coming out from Koji Igarashi-san, which is his spiritual successor to the Castlevania series.
Isn't that partnering with Deep Silver as well?
We believe it's still Deep Silver. I don't know that that's actually been confirmed. But, you know, an interesting for Bloodstained, he actually is, Igarashi-san is working with Inti Creates as well. Inti Creates, of course, they're incredible. They've done work for even games like the Shantae series. Just really, really stand up group of people. So, and Igarashi-san had said, you know, at the time of doing his crowdfunding, and, you know, he was basically very open about the fact that we are in discussions with publishers, and the biggest part of this campaign is to show, you know, that the interest is there, that the fans want this. So it wouldn't be surprising to me if I were to eventually hear that Concept already had been talking to Deep Silver even before the kickstarting campaign for Mighty Number 9 took off, is really where I'm trying to get with this. I don't think they ever intended to develop the game on $900,000. I think that was the amount of money that they needed to hit to prove that it was a viable project. But, you know, that raises some interesting questions, because a lot of people are like, oh, well, Inafune-san obviously meant to rip people off. He never could have intended to develop this game on $900,000. And I, again, you know, I just think that that is a misstatement of something that we know for fact, which is that in the modern age, publishers are very wary of smaller niche titles like this, and especially titles that require funding on their part. And they need to see proof that the game is going to, you know, have an audience. And I think Kickstarter is probably going to be moving forward a component of that we see these games tapping Kickstarter almost as like an advanced pre-order system for us to show that we're passionate about these games. So I want to dig in a little more, though, because, you know, Slaggy, as you say, the game's very ambitious. And for me, one of the things that we often see talked about with regard to Mighty No. 9 is that the game is ugly. And I will say, I do not think it's a particularly pretty game. Not only are a lot of the polygon models like very low polygon counts, like, you know, things just don't have very complex geometry. A lot of the art assets, the texture work is somewhat sloppy. There's also a lot of like motion blur that maybe didn't need to be there. There's a lot of like bloom effects to the extent that some of the in-game cues are actually lost in the sloppy art design. And, you know, I do think that that's a pretty big failing. A lot of people have pointed out, you know, the explosions are basically just like round polygon objects that just expand with a really ugly texture on them that basically looks like a close-up picture of cheese. A lot of the like smoke effects in the background are straight up like the exact same smoke effect, like sprite basically animated, that's been copy-pasted, you know, 20 times in the same frame to try and create the illusion of like a city on fire or something. It's charming to me, some of these things, because it's like, aw, that's how they did background design on the Super Nintendo. But in the modern day, it does not look particularly good. So, like, yeah, I know you had some struggles with the appearance of the game. Do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the fact that they were trying to release it for so many different consoles and handhelds, like, you know, I think it really affected what it could have looked like, you know, compared to that concept art. And I think it probably suffered for that. But I think for me, like, you know, it looked fine. I mean, it looks like a very dated game because of like all the consoles. It looks like it looks more like a like early PS3 or 360 game, just kind of with like, you know, the polygons not being super great, the texture work not being super great. But I mean, I was having issues too with like frame rate slowdown on the PS4.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Even on a PC, even on a very beefy PC, you will see some frame rate issues if you have too many characters on screen at the same time even. And you know, a big part of the problem with Mighty No. 9's performance, at least, is that I don't really think Unreal Engine was the right engine for what they were trying to do. They're trying to publish this game on the 3DS, on the PlayStation Vita, on PlayStation 3, Xbox 360. They're trying to get it on Linux and OS X, in addition to, you know, Windows PC, PS4, Xbox One, so Wii U. So, you know, and this is just not an engine that works well on half of those platforms. And, you know, it's also one of those instances where you sort of have to design for, like, the weakest platform and then hope you can scale up for the more powerful ones.
Right, that's why I was really surprised that it wasn't more like a sprite-based. So, I mean, it's not that I think it's ugly, it's just I thought that, like, a sprite-based direction would have... I mean, I don't know enough about how, you know, certain engines run, but, I mean, I feel like that would have maybe been less demanding.
Well, I agree it would have been less demanding, but then you also have to look at, you know, that is a lot more budget-heavy from the art, you know, generating the art assets perspective. Like, we can say all we want, like, oh, these graphics are ugly, these textures are ugly, this explosion looks like a pizza, but launching on literally... I keep saying 10, I think the actual count is 8. 8 or 9 platforms, launching on all these platforms with the game running all on Unreal Engine, like doing that for $4 million or whatever, that's actually quite an achievement. You know, we've seen a lot of flack from you know, the gamers and the gaming fandom, the gaming community, toward Harmonix, for example, for trying to crowdfund a $2 million Rock Band port for PC. And they were basically like, you know, I know a lot of people out there on the internet don't understand this, but even porting a game is very, very expensive.
Yeah.
So I think that's the reality, is that, you know, when you look at a $4 million budget, I mean, to me, I think a $4 million budget and like my mind is blown. But I think in the real world, and yes, they did get some money from Deep Silver for the sake of the actual publishing side of things. As I understand it, the game itself was primarily just developed on the crowdfunded money. I have yet to see like an official accounting of dollars. I would really like it if someday we did get that information. A lot of people feel like that would be very damning to Inafune-san. They feel like Inafune-san must have like taken the money and run. Like, that's the common statement you see. But like, we already know from other Kickstarters that Kickstarter themselves takes a fairly huge cut of the money, and then also producing all the physical goods that get promised on these Kickstarters. And in this case, there was stuff like custom made USB drives in the shape of an NES cart or a Famicom cart. And even just offering two options is going to cost a huge amount of money, because, you know, molds need to be be made and what have you. If it's a limited run item, then of course that's actually going to cost more than if you were having, you know, hundreds of thousands of these things made in bulk. So these kinds of things get very expensive, and ultimately in the scope of things for what they were doing, $4 million is not that much money. And again, ignoring that they did not actually get $4 million after Kickstarter takes its cut. People would have transactions get rejected or whatever. We don't get adjusted numbers for that. So it's very likely that the actual budget of the game was much lower than that $4 million that we all keep going on. So, you know, I say all of this because one of the big criticisms for the game that is leveraged against it basically is that it looks hella budget. And it does look hella budget, but it's also a budget game. I bought the super special edition of the game that came with DLC, it came with a statue. It was still $60. The game in the store, of course, PSN, eShop et al., is $19.99. This is a budget game. Like, people seem to be judging it as if it should look like Uncharted or something, but no, it's a little $20 budget game. And that, I think, is really the rubric upon which it should be being judged. Slaggy, you looked like you had a comment to make.
Oh, no, I mean, I think that, you know, it's more than just how it looks, though. It's how it plays, so.
Well, then why don't we talk about how it plays? And I want you to start this off because I actually very much like the way it plays. So I don't want to start. I would prefer you to start. Well, and I mean, I will not come for you.
I overall like the way it plays. I mean, I would say that, you know, it's definitely Mega Man. but, you know, there's some elements that are kind of like Mega Man X-ish to a degree. Not exactly, but there's a certain degree. And there's a cool mechanic where you, like, dash when an enemy is damaged enough and you can absorb their Xel, which is like their energy or whatever, so you can get temporary power-ups from them, and that's pretty cool. So I mean, it essentially, you know, it plays like a Mega Man style game, you know.
Well, and something that's interesting to me, and I think a lot of people just wanted straight up a new Mega Man, but I actually feel like this is a further evolution of Mega Man game design. And let me be clear before I say that, I actually think that from a game design perspective, there are a lot of things wrong with Mega Man or Mighty Number 9. But overall, I want to say that, you know, they actually took the Mega Man game design, and I actually think took it to the next level. They really took a lot of the stuff that was pioneered in the Mega Man X and the Mega Man the Mega Man Zero series, as far as like time attack and score attack functions. You know, they added this whole concept where, you know, after you've damaged an enemy past a certain point, and that point is the same across all enemies of a given type. So, you know, you start to learn like, oh, this little robot, I need to shoot him 3 times before I can dash. And if you dash within 1 second of it getting into that sort of like phase where it can be absorbed, you'll actually get like 100% bonus, and it will start counting a combo meter, and you'll start getting increasing like a score multiplier based on how high your combo number is. For the enemies that you absorb, that when you absorb, you start getting like health tank bonuses. You'll get bigger bonuses if your combo count is higher, as far as I can tell. And so it creates a huge focus on forward momentum, to the point where every time I would see a series of enemies on the screen, it almost became a little puzzle to figure out, like, how does this game want me to continue getting a 100% combo on these absorbs for all 4 of the enemies on screen right now? And in that regard, I actually felt like it surpassed a lot of the game and level design of the original Mega Man games.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, what was that?
I was just going to say, you know, coming from someone who is not as skilled at the Mega Man games as you are, you know, Mega Man games are known to be, you know, fairly tough. But I mean, I think for me, like, part of what I liked about something like Mega Man 2, for example, you know, which is for many people probably the
one Apex? Apex?
Yeah, like it's one of the
Zenith,
one of the best games ever for a lot of people. Is that I could kind of like, if I was trying to figure out, like, you know, like, oh, I need to jump at this time to avoid getting hit by that enemy's you know, little bullet or whatever, or that, you know, oh, I need to jump from this point on the ledge to, you know, get to that point. Like, I feel like you had the time to kind of figure that out. And even though I liked the dash component, I almost felt like I had to rush through instead of trying to, you know, focus on the platforming.
And I think that's a valid concern. And I think that actually goes to sort of what was expected versus what Inafune-san actually accomplished. I do feel that they took the game design to another level. I do truly feel that way. But the question that needs to be asked, you know, we haven't had a proper canon Mega Man game in like a decade at this point. So the question has to be asked, like, is that the right call? People wanted a new Mega Man game. They did not want a new game in the style of Mega Man, but different. And I feel like that's one of the big disconnects here. Like, for me, you know, I replay the Mega Man games all the time. I replay the Zero games and ZX games in particular even more. I love the Zero and ZX games almost even more than I like the original Mega Man games. So, you know, this Mighty No. 9 takes a lot of cues from those, because a lot of these momentum ideas were really, for this series, first integrated in the ZX series. So, you know, it's somewhat problematic, I think, that people who were expecting a new Mega Man 2, for example, I think they jumped into Mighty No. 9, and it's like, you know, this is, like, so hard. This focus on momentum is, like, back-breaking to me. I think the problem is that Inafune-san really designed it for Mega Man super fans. That, to me, is one of the big issues here. There's a huge reliance on, in the game and level design, on, like, one-hit kill abilities that the Robot Master have, a lot of one-hit kill level objects and obstacles, like a lot of like instant death spikes or lasers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel that these things are necessarily good game design, but I also, okay, let me rephrase. For the environmental stuff, I don't think it's necessarily bad game design. For the Robot Masters, I do. I don't think a boss should ever have an instant kill move. The fact that basically every boss has one in this game,
right,
is something I actually find deeply irritating and very poor game design. That for me should be left to like hard mode or maniac mode. Regular mode should be, you know, fair. You can watch your enemy, you can learn his patterns, you can respond, and even if you make a minor mistake or two, still win.
I think that was my biggest struggle with it. Really.
This is game design that demands perfection. It demands you to see the pattern as it's forming and anticipate where it's going. That is something I was able to do. I have finished the game. I actually just finished it this morning. But, you know, I know a lot of people, even long-term Mega Man fans, who are unable to perform that level of, like, perfection reliably every time. And I don't think that's unreasonable. I think the game is designed unreasonably in that regard. Within stages, something I liked actually, though, and this is something Mega Man does a lot, is that all of the instant death obstacles in the core game are, like, a hot pink color. And I think that's actually a really consistent design. I think that really does communicate to the player when they see that pink, like, immediately you know, I can't touch that. And I actually think that's actually fairly okay game design.
Yeah.
But the one hit kill stuff, I actually do think that's unreasonable. Something else that Inafune-san did, though, to sort of further the game design is, these Robot Masters, they're, you know, the Mighty Number series, but I'm just gonna call them Robot Masters because, let's be real, that's what they are. When you beat one, you take its ability, and then when you go to the next stage where its ability will be useful, not only will their ability do extra damage on the boss of the stage, they will actually come and help you out in the level. Like, there's one level where there are towers falling on you from the background. You're platforming as these towers are falling, and they will kill you almost immediately. It's awful. But if you save the flying one, then he'll actually, like, fly in the background and, like, start pushing the towers over it back further into the background so they don't interfere with your platforming at all. Meanwhile, they're, like, having little, like, dialogue with Beck, the main character, Mighty No. 9. And I actually found it really charming. I really liked that because it made me feel like these levels existed in the same world rather than being little disparate experiences. I felt like it was really cohesive, and I felt like it was sort of in the early Mega Man X games you would see stuff like that. So it sort of felt like the realization of the promise of early Mega Man X, where, you know, if you do Chill Penguin stage before, is it Spark Mandrill or the fire one, that the whole stage will be icy and you won't have to worry about those pits or what have you that would have hazards in them. That happens in every stage in Mighty No. 9, has something like that, where if you've done a different stage first or done something specific, it will make the other stages easier. I think that is phenomenal game design.
It's too bad that
every time I got to a mighty number, I was like, oh, I'm just starting to learn the mechanics of this boss, but every hit it does takes away half my health, so I can't get a chance to, you know, really get better at it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's one I saw a lot of people online having a hard time with. For me, it was the easiest. I don't mean that as a humble brag. I died against all of the mighty numbers the first time I encountered them, except the ice one, Cryogen or whatever. In-game, they just start calling her Cryo, and so in my head, she's Cryo. She has this really irritating ability that if it connects, you get blocked in a case of ice.
Yes.
And the rest of her routine cancels, and you have no chance of hitting her. So it's like, you can get her to a point where you can damage her, and then if you, like, accidentally get hit by her, like, stray beam or whatever, she will exit her vulnerability animation to come attack you as you're an ice block.
And you have a very small window of time to get free from the ice block.
Yeah, to me, it's extremely punishing design. It demands perfection. And I think that's very inappropriate. I have no real defense for that. I was still able to clear it, but I think it's inappropriate. I do. I think that is the kind of thing that should be reserved for hard mode, really. Like, this attack hits you, I'm no longer in my vulnerable state, and I'm coming for you right now. No, that's messed up. I don't think that's good design. The reason why I say all these things, the real point I'm trying to make here, I think Mighty No. 9 is a really fun game. I think it has a ton of really fantastic concepts.
Concepts?
All right. I do think they failed to gel, so per se.
Did you say they failed to Zell?
Oh, man. Mighty Punder 9 over here. So it's a little bit of a mess, though. And that's the thing. I think the game is messy. I think a lot of the people on the internet who are speaking down about it hella hard either didn't play the game at all or played it for a very short period of time and then bought into the internet hype that, like, this is a shit game.
I mean, it's not Kusoge. I was just going to say that.
No, I don't think it's Kusoge at all. To me, if we were using a full 10-point scale where, like, you could actually assign a game, like a 6, and it would mean, oh, this is actually above average, but flawed. It's messy. I would actually say it's like a 6.57 on a full 10-point scale.
Which magazine was it that used the range from, like, the guy who was, like, really depressed looking to the one who was, like,
that was Game, that was GamePro.
That's what I thought. If I was a GamePro ranking this, it'd be, like, kind of like the yawning guy. Or whatever.
You know, on like a letter grade thing for me, this would be like a C. Like a C plus. And, you know, a lot of people out there are basically saying it's like the equivalent of an F. It's abysmal. It's unplayable. I don't think any of those things are true. I think it's a flawed game. It has a lot of issues. But I actually, you know what other game was a flawed game with a lot of issues? Was the original Mega Man. And Mega Man 2 is one of the all-time classics of the art form of games. So, I don't know. I'm not done with Mighty No. 9. I still want to do the DLC campaign for Ray. I haven't done that yet. I haven't done any of the multiplayer stuff. But the core game, I found it very rewarding. I was very satisfied with it. I really enjoyed it. Again, despite the occasional frustration, there were times where it sang, where it felt better than classic Mega Man. And for me, the frustration was worth it for those moments where it really did gel and come together, even if just for a moment.
Yeah, I don't know if the design intentions were clearly communicated. Maybe I just didn't follow the development.
I agree. I don't think they were, because again, you know, everyone's expectation, not just you, everyone's expectation was for a new Mega Man.
Was there a demo? I can't remember.
There were. There was several demos. Like, they did a like super beta release of just like the openings demo stage. And then during one of the delays, they did like a backer release of like 4 of the Mighty No. stages. And that actually, as I recall, got data mined, and that's how we found a lot of information about Mighty No. 9 super early. So, you know, we did know how the game was going to play, like, if you really looked into it, but that was never, I felt, clearly designed never clearly communicated by Keiji Inafune, by Comcept. I think that they sort of always were selling it as a return to classic Mega Man, and that is just not what the game is on any level. In that regard, I feel like there was miscommunication, absolutely.
And I mean, I think it also raises issues about how do you design for today's audience.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, maybe people were like, oh, you know, it's too bad, get good, you know, the whole get good thing about, like, you know, like, if you're just not good at it, it's not your problem. But, you know, I feel like on, you know, to compare to like something like Nintendo, who's really done a good job at having, you know, ways that, you know, they can have challenge while also still accommodating for, you know, other players. Like, I mean, I look to like New Super Mario Brothers U as an example, and then, like, you know, New Super Luigi U was, you know, a lot more challenging. But
But I mean, even if you go back to Super Mario Brothers 2 Lost Levels, I mean, that was a game. Even, you know, so even back in, you know, the 80s, you know, when we talked about that, you know, this whole idea of Nintendo hard, and, you know, even with Mario 2 being deemed too hard for Western audiences. I mean, I think I'm not saying that it needed to be dumbed down, but I'm really surprised that the only accommodation for difficulty was, oh, you can go up to 9 lives before a game over.
I'm sorry, what was that last part?
Just that I was really surprised that the only thing that really seemed to accommodate for the difficulty was, oh, you can go up to 9 lives if you needed more of like a handicap or whatever.
Yeah, and I agree. You know, I just feel like the game, I think it is tuned too hard. I think it's tuned for people like me that have played literally every Mega Man game, every spin-off Mega Man game. That is, of course, exempting the one weirdo Wonder Swan Mega Man game that I haven't played. But ignoring that, I don't think it was tuned for people who have limited Mega Man experience but want more. And I think that was a huge mistake on their part. I absolutely agree with you, Slidekick.
I mean, they
should have gone the more Nintendo route.
I mean, like I said, I don't know a lot about game development and game design, but I feel like it wouldn't have been too difficult to just have different difficulty levels.
Well, and that's the weird thing, is that there actually are multiple difficulty levels. There are hard modes. There's like a maniac mode, but I don't think there are any easier difficulty modes.
And that's the thing, like the mode that it plays on should have been like hard. I feel like there should have been a normal mode that, you know, played more like, you know, like what we would expect a normal Mega Man to. And then like maybe even an easy mode if you just wanted to play through and, you know, not worry about, you know, the actual combat, and you wanted the challenge to just be from the platforming. Like, I know people are like, oh, easy mode, good.
Anyone who says that is garbage. You should be able to play any game you want the way you want. And I agree with that. You know, I would never play on a mode like that, because that's not, for me, I wouldn't get what I'm looking for out of that experience. But if you would, who gives a fuck? Like, everyone else is wrong if they say that you wanting that is wrong. Like, straight up, you are in the right here.
I just think options,
yeah,
are better than not having options.
I completely agree. They're not options I would use, and I still think they should be there, and that it would be a better game across the board if they were there.
And like I said, I just, with my limited knowledge, like, and please, if you're more knowledgeable about, you know, platformer design in particular, like, I feel like, you know, it would have just been like adjusting some formulas, saying like, you know,
and you know, it probably would be a little more complex than that, but I'm just gonna say it still would have been worth the effort. There have been Mega Man games as early as 2 that had selectable difficulties.
Yep. And like, my thing is that, oh well, you had your half of concept was out of work because the game was done, maybe go back and, like, that's the thing, while it was sitting basically finished, that's why I feel like, I mean, I don't think it's like an unpolished turd necessarily, but
it is unpolished.
It's unpolished, and the fact that it was just sitting there, and I mean, I guess maybe they just didn't have the money, like, but...
Well, and that's the thing, is that, you know, I agree, I understand what you mean about, like, you know, they had the game on lock for like a year plus, not doing anything with it while they were just trying to debug it, and I get why. You know, if you're trying to debug the game, you can't be adding stuff, because that could potentially introduce new bugs, but I do wish they could have made it a better game in that window. But, you know, I say better game, I actually ultimately really enjoyed Mighty No. 9. I think I'm going to look back on the year 2016 at the end of the year, I think Mighty No. 9 is going to be one of the games that I had the most fun with. Despite all the frustration, despite all of the badness, like, it is not super common for me in the modern age to get all the way through a game in it the week it comes out. I don't have all that much time for gaming, but I made time for Mighty No. 9. I ultimately got a lot out of it, and I think that's my struggle here. I recognize it's not perfect, but people are reading it so hard for things that I think are really superficial. The things I'm seeing it read most hard for are things like the pizza textures on the explosions or what have you. Like, okay, yeah, they look ugly. But, like, so what? You've never enjoyed an ugly game before? Jesus.
I mean, I could play a game that looks ugly if it plays well, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's part of the difference, is that, you know, I think Mighty No. 9 mostly plays very, very well, and you don't, and that's okay.
I mean, I guess I could see where, like, if they knew they were going to have to severely scale back on the, you know, what they wanted it to look like originally visually, you know, they almost should have been a little bit campy with it. And, you know, been a little bit like been like, okay, well, we're gonna have to really scale back with the visuals, but let's be like tongue in cheek about it almost, and make it part of like, oh, cute, you know, they're trying to make it like a early PlayStation Mega Man X game or something, you know.
You know, I actually think that would have gone over even worse, but I would have appreciated that.
And I don't know, like, I mean, I think for me, like, I didn't find, like, from what I play, like, the levels were designed all right, but they weren't the most, you know, like, as, in terms of the platforming, I didn't find it as fun or as rewarding to, like, go through some of the levels as, you know, something like Mega Man X or Mega Man 2. I felt like a lot of the levels, too, were, like, very, like, didn't have a lot of verticality in the levels.
Yeah, something about that, though, is specifically, you know, a lot of the very vertical Mega Man X games are so because X has that really cool wall slide ability.
Yeah.
And Mighty No. 9 does not have it. I actually thought that was a huge misfire. I thought there were several times in the game that I actually tried to do that just reflexively, and then when I didn't grab onto the wall, I was like, gosh darn it.
Yeah.
I was mad.
I mean, if I found that I was having to use the dash creatively to solve, which, I mean, then that was kind of interesting.
Well,
but...
and that's actually something, you know, I did that today. I was playing, Xander was here watching me finish it, and there were a couple of times I like would miss a platform and I have to like dash very creatively to get back to where I came from, and every time it landed, it felt really great, and he was like, what, that was crazy to watch, that was cool. And it's like moments like that for me are where the game sings. I'm ultimately actually okay with it not having the wall grab ability, not having that level of verticality. I actually just wish the game would make you do more of the interesting dash stuff, stuff like there's one stage of the radio tower where the flying man is. There are like upward gusts of wind, and the game doesn't tell you this, but if you air dash in that, your air dash will actually like move you vertically up through the stage, and it actually completely changes the feel of the platforming there. And that actually comes back in like the last like Dr. Wily style areas, and I really enjoyed that because, you know, it's very different from anything I've experienced in any other Mega Man game. It required me to like use all of my abilities at the same time while also using them interestingly, and I actually felt like in those segments, doing it successfully and succeeding, I felt like a pro. Like, it was a great feeling when it clicked like that. But, you know, you also had, and I do want to call out, there were a couple of things, like, there are these really weird, like, hot pink spirals in one stage that you have to, like, duck dash under, except the game never tells you what a duck dash is before that, and you get literally a prompt on the platform you have to do that on that literally says, hint, use your duck dash. And it's like, if your game design is so bad, if your game design is so, I said bad, but if it is so incommunicative of what's expected of you that you have to artificially have a pop-up telling you what to do, you need to redesign your stage. This is wrong. Like, Full Tilt, and there's no real excuse for that. The game has it's a very flawed game. The thing that upsets me is that I think there's also a lot to enjoy, and I think a lot of people are going to give up on it before they get to that, both because of the very negative word of mouth and because of the exacting expectations and in the encounter design of the game.
I mean, there was definitely some moments that made me feel like I was playing a Mega Man game. There's one of the levels where like you had to go down and the walls were like pink spikies, and you had to, you know, maneuver your falling in a way so that you wouldn't hit it, and I was like, okay, that's very Mega Man. And you know, it's just it was, you know, for a game that was delayed so much, it felt like it needed more time in development. I think that was my biggest struggle with it,
and that is, again, you know, that's a funding issue to me. I mean, I see that
that's a bigger issue than anything about how it looks, because like I was comparing it to something like DuckTales Remastered when we were talking, and even though, you know, DuckTales Remastered in retrospect has some very dull art assets and such, like and you know, that was actually kind of controversial at the time too. A lot of people had issue, but I thought that Way Forward made it feel like the original DuckTales did. And you know, I mean, then again, you know, that was a remaster rather than, you know, a new game, a new evolution of a game. But still, like, I mean, there were some things that just didn't feel right, so I feel like it needed more time. I mean, I'd be really interested to see. I don't know if we're gonna get any patches to this. I don't know if we're gonna see a Mighty No. 9 Part 2 or whatever, just because of such, like, what a negative reception it got. But I mean, I would really honestly be interested to see, like, the ideas here, like, done smoother, fixed. I mean, even if it was something like someone, a fan making an 8-bit demake of it, you know, and, like, addressing some of the issues.
I would almost not be surprised if we don't see the PC version get modded in some of these ways, frankly. Some of the level design issues smoothed out by modders, probably, you know, some of the one-hit kill moves disabled for bosses. I, I would almost put money on that happening, frankly.
Yeah, and I mean, I would be willing to give that a chance, but, you know, just the fact that that's requiring the community to get involved, I mean, that's...
Yeah, it's inappropriate for sure, but, you know, when we actually have to start wrapping this up, we've been talking about Mighty No. 9 for a long time.
For a mighty long time.
Yes, well, the thing is, again, I enjoyed it enough, I'm very passionate. I could talk about Mighty No. 9 a lot longer. I feel like there's so much we didn't touch on. Like, there are some really weird visibility issues on the underwater stages that's like, what are you guys thinking? Like, you nailed how underwater gameplay should work in Mega Man 2. Literally, Mega Man 2 set the stage for all other 2D platformers.
I'm like, that's why I went to that stage first. I was like, oh, the water stages are usually a good time. Oops.
Yeah, and I actually liked that underwater stage a lot, but like, I literally had to turn on the brightness of my TV. Like, that's inexcusable. That is so dumb. What were you all thinking? So anyway, though, I ultimately still got a lot out of the game. For me, it was almost like a must play experience. I've seen a lot of people come after it who haven't even played it. I think that's gross and dumb.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I was very happy with it. And I really hope we see a sequel. I really hope we get like a Mighty No. 10. I want to wrap this conversation up. I want to talk about this article that Kotaku ran. And Sagi, I think you actually linked me to this. So why don't you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, there were actually a couple great articles, but I mean, I thought it was really, I don't know if I want to say admirable, but, you know, it was very honorable, I guess, of Inafune-san to pretty much own up to the game's shortcomings.
Yeah, so he basically was saying, you know, I own the problems that came with this game. He did this great piece with Kotaku. We'll link you to it over on GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
And he basically talked about a lot of the issues as far as like designing this game, crowdfunding it, with regard to people being upset. You know, he basically says, you know, he doesn't want to make an excuse or whatever, but like he owns the game. He owns all the problems with it. He's the key creator and he owns that responsibility. But at the same time, a lot of these issues that came up are because they were trying to make this game on so many different platforms. He also talked about the fact that, you know, we saw the Kickstarter campaign, we saw the number of money they got, and
like
he claims that they actually pocketed for development about 60% of that. So that already changes so much. He then talked about how, you know, Capcom, where he really came up, you know, they were known for their multi-platform strategy, and so that's what they learned. They learned, like, he sort of came up with multi-platform strategy being the norm and being what you have to do. But, you know, the other people who have, you know, made comments about, you know, Inafune-san just being focused on being a businessman and working on, you know, taking the IP in different directions. In fact, Hideki Kamiya-san was one of those people. He very notably had said that he didn't see Inafune-san as a game creator. He saw him as a businessman. Ben Judd over at, is he with Intercreates or is he with 8-4 or Fangamer or someone?
I can't remember, but he's done a lot with Iga as well.
Yeah, both Inafune-san and Igarashi-san.
He was the one who, like, did an interview in a towel, right?
Yeah, yeah. And he's a reasonably handsome guy, so that was okay. But anyway, he basically said, you know, that whether those things are true or not is actually kind of irrelevant, that for what Inafune-san does as like a manager of Comcept, like his goal really is for him to be doing things working with the IP rather than directly with the game. And I actually don't disagree with that. If you really stop and think about it, Mighty No. 9 had a director, it had a producer. Inafune-san's job was not the day-to-day stuff, it was the overall concept and taking responsibility for the overall release, and I think that he's done that. So I felt like, you know, it's good that we got this feedback. I thought that it was good that, you know, we have all of this stuff sort of talking about our expectations, sort of where the money went. So per se, I would still love to see a detailed budget of where the money went, of course, but I do not think the game was mismanaged. I don't think the money was mismanaged. I think the reality is they tried to make a game on an engine that was not appropriate for it. They tried to launch on 10 platforms, which it was not the right engine for it. I think that there were just some fundamental mistakes made. I think the game isn't as good as it it could have been, but I still think it's actually a pretty cool game. And, you know, ultimately it is what it is, but I would really, for me, my recommendation is strongly that, like, you should probably play it before you judge it. Give it a chance. You might like it.
Even if it means waiting for it to get a, like, you know, sale or something. Like,
yeah, I will be shocked if this holiday season we don't already see it deeply discounted on platforms and one of those, like, $5 Steam sale games, truly.
Yeah.
And I think at that point, it's going to be, like, a must recommend, 100% should play.
And I also want to just quickly shout out Forbes and Ars Technica, both did articles in the past day or so that I felt were really, like, level-headed, and they weren't just being like, this game is crap, it's a disappointment. They tried to, like, take really reasonable looks at them. So we'll link you to those over on GameBuoy.org as well.
GameBuoy.org. And I think that's very cool, truly. I am totally okay with people not being into the game. The thing that gets me is how many people I've seen just unabashedly dump on it who haven't even played it.
Yeah.
Because the big internet meme is like, LOL, it's garbage. And I don't think it's garbage. I think it's flawed, but I think a lot of great games have been flawed over the years.
When thankfully our listeners seem to be very reasonable, even those who didn't play it, we got some feedback for our question of the week, which was unpopular opinion time. This week we're digging into Mighty No. 9. Have you played it? What do you think? We got our first tweet was from Games Are a Drag, who said, I'm sure it plays okay, but I'm not living for the budget aesthetic. Pizza explosions, crashes, party city character design. So, I mean, and that's definitely, you know, it's not the prettiest game, but I appreciated that Games Are a Drag didn't be like, oh, it looks like dung, you know, like, was it Xenoblade Chronicles that looked like dung?
I think the original looked like dung comment was about Daisen Ryaku 7 for Xbox.
Oh, that's right. And then we got a tweet from Dungeon Buster saying, it's not the beast of the Kickstarter apocalypse, at least for me. Played far worse from AAA Studios, had its fun moments. Full disclosure, was also a backer on the project, was also not one of my favorite Kickstarter experiences towards the end.
Interesting. I think that's a really interesting take.
And over on the Book of Faces, which still sounds like a Silent Hill game title, over on Facebook, we have Mike I, better known as Act Deft, saying, no, I didn't buy into the hype of the Kickstarter back then, and I'm still not sure if I really want to play it, but I'm curious to see if the game is really as bad as people claim. Well, hopefully, especially Captain Spike's insight on it will help a lot of you out there, you know, kind of weigh your decision. I kind of wish that I had known, I mean, if I had known it was going to be so difficult, I maybe wouldn't have pledged for it, but, you know, I mean, that's just me. But we also didn't talk about the 3-hour credit roll.
That you know, everyone says that, but, like, you can skip it, you can skip the entire thing, you can skip in batches of 10,000 or 1,000. Like, the game gives you so many options.
And it's like, I can't find my Mighty Number. It's like, they email that to you when you pledge, so.
Yeah, they email you your Mighty Number when you initially pledged. You can even do a search through the credits for your Mighty Number, even on the console versions. I just saw the credits this morning. I can definitely confirm that for you for fact.
Did you find us?
I did not. I did not actually look. I was way more eager to, you know, get recording on this episode.
Okay.
So, but I didn't watch the whole thing, but I did see, you know, you had multiple skipping options. You had the ability to search for a Mighty Number. So to me, I see people throwing it shade at like this 3 or 4 hour credits roll.
I thought it was kind of funny.
And it's like, it is a little funny, but also they promised people a spot in the credits roll. Like, are y'all even thinking about your complaint right now? Like,
I mean, I guess would you rather have that or it be so tiny print that you can't even see it?
Right? Exactly. No, to me, this was actually the best implementation to fulfill their promise. I think they did perfectly. So I think that's like, I don't mind you bringing it up as an LOL, but I think the fact that some people are actually complaining about it is very sad to me. So, yeah. Anyway, moving forward, we have a very slight rumor this week.
Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it.
We are again hearing rumblings of a Red Dead Redemption backwards compatibility release on the Xbox One for the Xbox 360 release of the game. We don't yet know if this is going to be a real thing. A few weeks ago, Red Dead Redemption was made playable for Xbox One preview members. As I understand, it did not work perfectly well, but it was working better than the last time it was made playable. So it definitely seems to me something that they're working working on and trying to get going.
Yeah.
Hopefully we will see it soon down the line.
Indeed.
All right. Well, with that having been said, let's start wrapping up by talking about what's up.
I said, hey, what's going on?
This week, I have been playing Mighty No. 9. I just told you all about it. Last night, I played about an hour and a half of Tokyo Mirage Sessions Sharp FE, which came out yesterday. That was great. It definitely, to me, feels like basically when they were making Shin Megami Tensei Cross Fire Emblem, someone was standing in a boardroom like, hey, what can we do to make this game appeal to more audiences? And I feel like someone must have been like, let's take Persona and make it a magical girl game. And that's basically what it is. It's like Persona, but like with magical girl elements and a focus on Japanese pop music. I'm super here for it.
And I mean, I like that you were already talking last night about how you want to see, and I agree, like sharp AC for Animal Crossing, you know, like that this could be like, aside from the fact that it flopped in Japan, it seems to be really positively received here. I hope that they would make, they'd be willing to make more Mirage Sessions, sharp, whatever.
Well, and that's the funny thing is that, you know, the idol focus is actually a huge turnoff to a lot of the Japanese fan base. The people who are into Idoru stuff, like, they are really into it, but everyone else probably looked at it as like, okay, that's otaku garbage. I don't want this. Like, so it's actually here. I bet it's going to do a lot better here. Very similar to, like, the Virtue's Last Reward 999 games, where, you know, those did better here than they did in Japan.
That's true.
And, you know, now that's like a very well-loved series, even in Japan, I believe, even though still primarily here. I would be very interested in seeing if Tokyo Mirage Sessions can do that kind of success where it is, you know, makes a profit here and we can make up for it flopping in Japan.
Yeah. And I almost wonder if something like if it wasn't focusing on idols and J-pop, but you know, still was like a Persona with Nintendo character personas basically that had a
well, and let's be clear, I don't think it's the J-pop focus that put people off in Japan. I think it's specifically the focus on idol culture, because that's viewed as like a very nerdy, unpleasant like subgenre. Like it's for otaku, and you know we in North America use otaku just to be like, oh, they're a super nerd. But in Japan, being otaku, like that's not a good thing. Like that's like a very, very bad thing to say about somebody. So I, you know, it's in Japan, they were like, okay, this is garbage for those garbage people. So I think they could keep the focus on J-pop and just get rid of the idol stuff. And even then, I'm not saying, you know, get rid of like the characters becoming, you know, musical personas or whatever, just the specific, like literally being a game about idol singers, because that is, you know, it starts off as almost like behind the scenes look at idol culture. And I think that put people off, but I am not an expert. So if you have a different take on that, I'd love to hear it. Otherwise, I also played a lot of WoW in the last couple weeks. My character is sitting pretty very nearly at level 100. I was worried I wasn't going to make 100 with my monk before the next expansion, and now I'm like I wonder if I can get the meta achievement for flying in Draenor before the expansion.
I'm like, or you could just level up like your DK.
I would probably rather get flying in Draenor first, but that is also an option. Yeah, what about you, Slag? What have you been playing?
I've been playing more WoW. I'm trying to think. I think it's been between the last time we recorded and now that I got my Druid to 100. I can't remember if I talked last time about getting him to 100, but he's
well,
at
100. Congrats.
And so that's good. I also played some Mighty No. 9.
Excellent.
And that's about it. I was out of town, so I didn't get as much gaming time in between E3 and now. So definitely looking. I want to pick up Sharp FE super bad. Like, I'm already sold on it after. I can't believe that I didn't pre-order it. I guess I didn't realize that it was so Persona.
Oh, yeah. It's super Persona. It's basically a Persona game with a different skin.
Because I thought it was going to be more Mega 10, which I still haven't connected with, honestly. But it's Persona
AF.
So that's what what I've been playing.
And with that, I think we will go to our social links to all catch up on a couple of tweets. You know, we just were at you recently with E3, so, you know, we just have a couple to catch up on. That Retro Code retweeted our E3 wrap-up and said, yeah, thank you. Your Enzyme had tweeted originally that it's not yet available on my favorite podcast listening services, Frowny. I should really sleep anyway. I feel very badly about that. Last, when I checked, you know, a day or so later, it appeared to be up on all the services, but please, if you're ever having any issues not being able to access our show on your favorite listening place, or there is a place that you would like us to, you know, be on. We are on Google Play now, but if there's any other big ones that I'm not aware of, please let us know. And then you had mentioned something about Pikachu Fuck You Ditchu.
Oh yeah, just randomly. Someone was talking about favorite N64 games. I believe that was at GamerFox.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was mentioning that I really liked how experimental some of the N64 games were at that time. I mentioned Pikachu, Hey You Pikachu, Pikachu Genki Ditchu, which we here in studio once coined Fuck You Pikachu and Pikachu Fuck You Ditchu.
And that was actually from Smash, right? Because your Pikachu...
I believe so.
Oh, it was a Pikachu, like a amiibo or something.
A that Pikachu was CPU?
A Pikachu CPU Fuck You Ditchu. And that's it for our tweets.
All right.
But also happy birthday. We did do our N64 episode last year, you know, to be episode 64, but was that last year or was that the year before?
It was a while ago. Keep going.
Just saying, happy birthday to N64. I feel like, Sonic also had his 25th. We also did that a little earlier on, but happy birthday to both of them. Oh, we didn't even talk about the shade that the Sonic Twitter threw at Mighty No. 9.
Yeah, I don't think it's worth too much discussion, basically.
Sonic Twitter being Sonic Twitter.
Yeah. You know, there's a quote that was misattributed to Inafune-san that basically was saying he didn't care about Mighty No. 9 fan concerns because at least they got something. It's better than nothing. That is not something he actually said. He has repeatedly stated that is not something he said. The internet, of course, doesn't care. It's good shade or whatever, and shade culture, I guess, rules all, so everybody's crucifying him for something that never actually happened. Mm. And even the Sonic Twitter went in on it. You know, they were like, congrats on the release, Mighty No. 9.
It's better than nothing.
It's better than nothing. And a picture of Sonic shrugging. And it's like, really, Sonic? You live in the most glass motherfucking house of all time.
Sonic
there
Boom.
Have been more shitty Sonic games than there have been shitty edutainment games on the Wii platform. There have been literally dozens of shitty Sonic games. Y'all can't even do emulations of Genesis re-releases right. Who
Ooh.
The hell are you?
Happy birthday, Sonic.
Fuck you, Sonic.
With that, we hope that you consider our episode and our podcast more than just better than nothing. But we do love your feedback. We like your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews, as well as Google Play and Stitcher Radio. We like your Facebook likes, and we effing love Twitter.
We effing love Twitter.
And you can email us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
And our home base is gamebuoy.org.
Gamebuoy.org.
And with that, it's time to roll out the shoutouts.
All right, as ever and always, my first shout out goes to VogNetwork.com. That is the Voice of Geeks Network, where you can hear all kinds of really great shows, including us, but not only us. You can check out Girls Gone WoW, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO, as well as Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues. You can also check out Ranger Pridecast, a show which I am on, along with Shane Alenko, discussing the current season of the Power Rangers meta series, as well as the current season of the Japanese Super Sentai series, upon which it's reversioned. You should also check out the Starboard Power Coupling podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail. And in non-VOG shows, you can check out Nintendo Love Fest, which does exactly what it says on the tin, as well as X Nation, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. I'd be remiss not to point you in the direction of the current currently on hiatus, Tables, Ladders, and Podcast, a professional wrestling podcast for the common man, as well as the currently on hiatus sister show to this show, Reading is Fundamental, that Slag Kicks show. I am also on it, as is Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio, and Delvin from VG Realness, talking about the current season of RuPaul's Drag Race.
And I would say off-season is more appropriate than hiatus.
Either way, it's on pause. Get this show rolling, Slaggy, take us a place.
Game Bar is the gay video game prairie home companion and a part of
the Hunty Bunch, along with VG Realness, that's video game realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends, La Palanca Podcast, podcast por y para gay gamers Latino-Americanos en Español, Joystick Jockeys, two LGBTQ gamers who love games and love talking about them, our allies over at the Nintendo Fun Club, your place for platformers, positivity, and pop-punk, as well as DSED. The DSED Podcast is where Game Buoy superfans Dan and Crystal level up their game development skills and discuss the daily grind along the way on a non-daily schedule. And of course, we have our sister ship in the SS Buoy fleet, which is Anime Buoy, your port of call for anime recommendations, news bits, and discussions that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be.
And we're actually about to record another episode of that in like 10 minutes. Fun!
I need some caffeine. So maybe I should go into the Great Fairy Fountain and drink some of that 40 we're pouring out for the... I guess 40 doesn't have a caffeine, but our wonderful theme music was done by Zelda Reorchestrated. You know, it's a great project. Rest in peace.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, guys. Thank you so much for being here with us today. I hope you've had half as much fun listening to us as we've had talking to you. We could not do the show without you, and we really appreciate your listenership. We'll be with you again probably in 2 weeks. We're actually going to get back to our twice a month schedule after this, I think. I'm very excited about that. You know, we've been going every week here for a couple weeks, and it's very tiring on my poor voice. That having been said, keep gaming.
Keep gaming.
Keep thinking.
Keep thinking.
And ad lib moaning in pain. Yeah, on the DLC stage for Rey in Mighty No. 9, literally there's one part where she's supposed to be moaning in pain, and instead of like having the subtitle say moan or ow or dot dot dot, it literally is like a stage direction saying ad lib moaning in pain.
Oh, wow.
Budget.
I can see your Pikachu's butt from here.
Are you ready?
Yes.